So, as you know, we missed a few weeks there that I did not originally plan to miss. For the near future, we're going to do 6 to 7:30 this week and next week to make up one class that we missed. And then I'm going to be in New Jersey after that. I have to go record with my partners up in New Jersey. And I'll probably die on the way, and then we don't have to worry about this. But provided I come back, we then need to say, what are we going to do? Because we are behind from what I scheduled, and I did schedule this ending the first week of June, which is, you know, a lot of people start doing stuff during the summer. So we're going to offer, and I know not everybody's here tonight, and that's a shame, but as always with these things, you get a vote if you show up. So I'm going to ask you, I guess, put your heads down or something. I don't know. We're going to count. I don't want anybody influenced. But I have three options. Option A, doing it like tonight, 6 to 7:30. Option B would be moving it up 5:30 and then ending at 7. And then option C would be doing it just an hour every night, but we'd be going into July. Okay? So, can I get hands for option A? Raise your hand for option A. I don't even know how many people are here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. How about option B? Option B. 1, 2, 3, 4. Are you voting twice? 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And then option C. Option C. Nobody wants to study the Bible over the summer. Okay, so we're going to go with option A. And as always, if you need to leave at 7, you can. You know, and then you can just pick up the rest recorded. I promised someone that all the good stuff would be between 7 and 7:30. But, you know, it is what it is. Okay. So we have a lot to cover tonight, which makes it the same as every other night. I will say that I'm still recovering and I'm kind of out of it. This was my first full day of being able to do stuff, so I did stuff all day and now I'm tired. And I'm not quite fresh on this stuff because I prepared this class like 4 different times and then kept on getting sick or having to cancel. So I was like, I got it. So Deuteronomy is one of the 5 Gospels. No, I'm totally kidding. Okay. We want to start tonight with a very interesting passage, which I should have marked ahead of time, but we hope that I can find right now. I believe it is 2 Kings chapter 22. Aha! Starting with verse 3. 2 Kings chapter 22, starting with verse 3. I'm going to read this out, some of it. I'm going to skip a few verses as we go along, just for the sake of brevity. In the 18th year of King Josiah, this is around the year 600, in the 18th year of King Josiah, the king sent Shaphan the son of Azaliah, son of whoever, to the house of the Lord, saying, go to Hilkiah the high priest, that he may reckon the amount of money which has been brought into the house of the Lord, which the keepers of the threshold have collected from the people, and let it be given into the hand of the workmen who have the oversight of the house of the Lord, and then give it to the workmen of the house of the Lord, repairing the house. So in other words, what's going on is they're doing renovations on the temple. Okay? You with me so far? Cool. And Hilkiah the high priest said to Shaphan the secretary, I have found the book of the law in the house of the Lord. And Hilkiah gave the book to Shaphan, and he read it, and Shaphan, the secretary, came to the king and reported to the king, your servants have emptied out the money that was found in the house and have delivered into the hand of the workmen who have the oversight of the house of the Lord. Then Shaphan, the secretary, told the king, Hilkiah, the priest, has given me a book. And Shaphan read it before the king. And when the king heard the words of the law, he tore his clothes. So, what happens here, it seems, is that there was a book of scripture that people forgot existed, and it was hidden behind a wall. And when they knocked down the wall for the renovation, they found a library and found a scroll that none of them had seen anymore. And the scroll says, we don't know. But what seems to happen is if you look at Josiah's response, and you look at the reforms that he immediately makes in the next chapter, scholars have argued quite convincingly that the book that was discovered was Deuteronomy. They didn't know it existed! Now, if you're among the more cynical scholars, you say that Hilkiah discovered the book, quote-unquote. Or as my seminary professor said in the past, blowing to dry the ink, look, we found this ancient book! Okay? And the reason why they might have invented it is because Deuteronomy is very heavy on the centralization of worship, and obviously people working in the temple would favor the centralization of worship. However, we should not take the cynical approach to this, I don't think. There are a number of reasons that point to Deuteronomy actually being an ancient text that really was lost and discovered. Another thing, I'm kind of jumping. Oh, look, I'm not even on the thing yet.
The mysterious book.
Sorry about that. Another thing that we need to keep in mind is that books written at this time and prophets preaching at this time tends to take on a very Deuteronomistic, is the word, character. And we'll talk about that after we talk about Deuteronomy itself, the Deuteronomistic history. In other words, they begin to read the covenant and they begin to read Israel's history in the light of the book of Deuteronomy. Okay? And we'll talk about what the light of the Deuteronomy is. We'll get there in a second. But this is a watershed moment in the history of Judaism and in the history of understanding Judaism and in the history of their self-understanding of what Judaism means. Okay. Did Moses write the book of Deuteronomy? Well, we've already talked about this some weeks in the past. Hard to write books in Hebrew before the Hebrew language exists to be written down. And also, Moses dies at the end of Deuteronomy, so unless he was just having a kind of depressive day, I don't think he wrote that part. Okay? I mean, of course, I say I die all the time after Mass, so maybe that's what happened, but no. Okay? Now, is there authority, as we mentioned, you know, this was weeks ago, but you may recall, is there authority that does go back to Moses? Could we say that Moses is the ultimate authority behind the book of Deuteronomy? Absolutely yes. Are some of the laws from Moses himself, maybe, are some of the speeches from Moses himself, less likely, though it still would have been something along the lines of what Moses could have said. It is a practice of ancient historians. This is something we don't do today. But they had different standards back then. It is a practice of ancient historians to invent speeches and put them in the mouths of historical characters, the kind of speech that the historical character should have said, but didn't. Just like none of us do. Okay? Have you ever been in a moment when, like, your wife, like, gave you a great gift? And you're like, say here. And then like 5 days later, you're like, oh, I should have said this. And it's so much more eloquent and developed. Of course. Nobody ever says it in the moment because nobody's that smart. But what historians do is they put speeches in the mouths of people of what they should have said. This is what they were probably feeling at the moment. When we get to the Gospels, this is going to be a little bit different because there are actual speeches from Jesus, but he also had people who were actual secretaries there among his apostles. So that's different. versus somebody writing a history centuries later and saying, well, what did Moses say? Well, he would have said something like this, you know. And that was respected historical practice at the time. That's what professional historians did. It seems weird to us. But you just need to know that, that this was the accepted practice in the ancient world. We're going to talk about another accepted practice in the ancient world later that's going to upset you. But there it is. Okay. So what can we say, then, about Deuteronomy? We can say a few more things before we dive into this very important book. And one of the things we can say is that it is the book of the Old Testament quoted the most by Jesus Christ. Jesus quotes Deuteronomy more than any other book of the Old Testament, and it's by a good margin. It is also a book that is quoted by 17 out of the 27 books of the New Testament. So even in the New Testament, even for Christianity, Deuteronomy has a rather important role. However, most people today, I think more of Genesis and Exodus and may not even be aware that Deuteronomy exists, which is weird considering how important it is. The events of Genesis and Exodus are very important. I will argue that the book of Deuteronomy is the most important of the five books of the Torah. Again, because of that wonderful experience we had in 2 Kings 22, it was the book that was discovered. And when the book was read, the king tore his garments. Oh my goodness. It would be not dissimilar, guys, to 300 years from now, us forgetting that we had a constitution. And somebody finding the constitution and not only saying, hey, this is a good document, but hey, this is the actual legal basis for our country. Oh, we're not doing anything right. So I want to say a few more things generally about Deuteronomy before we dive in. And we won't be able to dive into it much. It's a big book. Lots there. The word Deuteronomy is a Greek word. And it literally means second law. Okay? Second. So nomos is the word for law. In Greek, when you're autonomous, it means you're a law to yourself. Okay. Deutero is one way to say second or two. Okay. So it's connected to the word that we have for deuce. Okay. So Deuteronomy. Why is it called the second law? Because Moses repeats a lot of the law that he received at Sinai, but now we're on the plain of Moab. Moses knows he's going to die. Moses knows he can't go into the promised land. Moses knows this is a whole different generation of people than received the law of Sinai. And so he's going to repeat a lot of it. But he's also going to change some of it. And this is important too, that Deuteronomy represents a change to the law. Okay? The standards drop because of the experience of the sinfulness in the desert. And we see this happen in Jesus' ministry. Remember this? Moses said you could give a bill of divorce to a woman. And Jesus said, but from the beginning it was not so. Where does Moses allow divorce? Not on Sinai. In Deuteronomy. Now Moses is still speaking with the authority of God here. Okay? Moses is still called a prophet here. But there are laws that are passed in Deuteronomy that Ezekiel will later say were maybe bad laws. That Jesus implies were confessions to human weakness. Because of the hardness of your heart, Moses said so. These were not God's plan A, for lack of a better term. This was, you guys are so terrible, you can't even live the law. So Deuteronomy becomes a second law in that sense, too, right? It's like, yeah, fine, try this. However, I do want to say, I meant to say this earlier, I'm still not on top of my game, guys, sorry. When we were saying that it is an ancient text, one of the very interesting things about this, why we know or presume that it is not actually written in the year 600, that it was actually discovered in 600, but written centuries before, is because the form of Deuteronomy exactly matches the legal form of Hittite treatises from the 12 to 1100s BC. It matches it almost perfectly, point by point. In other words, this is the form that people understood law to be in circa 1200 BC. Nobody had any idea about this circa 600 BC. All of that had passed away. So, let me give you an analogy to show what I mean. The Magna Carta, great law that's very important, was passed in the 1200s in England. The Declaration of Independence, passed 1776. If someone wrote or discovered a book in 1777 that looked exactly like the Declaration of Independence and said that it had been hidden for centuries, you would have a right to be skeptical. If, however, somebody discovered a book that looked exactly like Magna Carta in a way that nobody was making laws in the 1700s and said, yeah, this is an ancient English law that we discovered, and you compared it to other English laws, and it looked exactly like other English laws, and the only people who would know what that would look like would be historians of law, then you'd either say, this guy's going all out to make a forgery, or it really is ancient. And most scholars seem to accept that. Some cynics say, no, they wrote it, but most scholars seem to say, no, it wasn't written by Moses. It was probably finally compiled within a century or two after Moses died. And then lost. Because things were chaotic for a while. One of the reasons why they say, hey, we don't think this was written in the year 600 is because as much as Deuteronomy insists on one place of worship, the one place of worship it insists on is not Jerusalem. And if you're going to forge a document to give yourself power, just go all the way. Okay? Just go all the way. Don't try to make an argument from exegesis. Just say, God told us to worship in Jerusalem. The end. Okay. Alright. The very last thing I want to say generally about Deuteronomy, before getting into it, is that it is the most rhetorical book of the five, and one of the most rhetorical books in the entire Old Testament. I mean this quite specifically. Rhetoric is the art of persuasion. It is also the training for composition and public speaking. From beginning to end, Deuteronomy is basically one big speech. Okay, it's Moses speaking. If you flip through it, you just keep on seeing open quotation marks at the beginning of every paragraph. It's Moses speaking the whole way through. And as he is speaking according to very good rhetoric and rhetorical laws from the ancient world. This is a highly crafted, highly skillfully written book. Okay? Very good literature from the ancient world. You will notice this. You may remember I mentioned Robert Alter, who tries to translate the Bible into flowing English. His translation of Deuteronomy is just magnificent. It's so clear that what he's working with is of a literary quality so much higher. And this literary quality, this rhetorical training, actually, again, sets the ground, not just for the Deuteronomistic history, which we'll talk about in a bit, because that's the content. The form sets the ground for the collection of books we'll talk about as the wisdom literature later. And Deuteronomy could, in some sense, be considered the first book of wisdom literature. It's not, because it's considered one of the five books of the Torah. But in terms of genre, it could easily be considered the predecessor to wisdom literature. Sirach, wisdom, Proverbs, all that. Not just the communication of the law of God, but a reflection on the law of God, drawing out the inner meaning of the law of God and communicating that to people. Are you all with me so far? I'm going to ask so I can take a sip of water. Okay. Couple of things. Again, there's a ton in Deuteronomy. A couple of things that we want to talk about is chapter 4. Moses begins to encourage to the observation of the law. He gives a long chapter. It's a beautiful chapter. We read it during Lent. A beautiful chapter on encouraging people to obey the law. And in fact, this is something that runs throughout all of Deuteronomy. God in Exodus said, here's the law, obey it, I just saved your butts. In Deuteronomy, there is a profound rhetorical appeal to why you should obey the law. Why you should follow it. And this rhetorical appeal talks about who God is, it talks about God's faithfulness, it talks about what obedience to the law will give Israel. You'll be the wisest in the sight of the nations. If you go toward the end of the book, he starts listing blessings and curses. This is where we have, it's in Deuteronomy, that we have the two ways, the path of life and the path of death. Choose life then that you should live and obey God's commandments. None of that in the earlier books of the Bible. Right? So this rhetoric is, I think, very important. It comes very close to a sermon, right? This is Moses' sermon. After having a whole life, it's put in his mouth, but still, it's inspired by God. Having a whole life of trying to get people to obey the law, Moses now knows that just commanding it is not enough. You have to persuade people to it. You have to persuade people to it. Okay? In the end of chapter 4, Moses begins to set forth the law, and I've already said some things about that, but he repeats a lot of it, but he changes some of it, he adds a few things. One of the things I want to say is, he gives the Ten Commandments again. And I think it's here. Yeah. It's here that they're called the Ten Words, the Decalogue in Greek. That idea of 10 words is important because it allows us to understand why God speaks 10 times in Genesis and etc. Right, it's not 10 laws, it's 10 words. 10 thoughts of God. Not 10, like, single words. 10 thoughts. 10 sentences. In fact, let me just take that for a moment. That's a good word. So, what has a subject, an object, and a verb? What does a judge pass? A sentence, right. So that kind of dual meaning is present in English too. A sentence is both a sentence, like it's a sentence, you're being sentenced by a judge, but it's also a thought, it's a complete thought. It's a formulation of principle. And so that's what's going on here. The reason I bring this up is because normally the Catholic division of the Ten Commandments comes from Deuteronomy. And the Protestant division of it comes from Exodus. So you know how you're like, oh, they get it wrong, we get it wrong. They're written slightly different. We take it from Deuteronomy, they take it from Exodus. Taking it from Deuteronomy, I think, makes more sense for a variety of reasons. One of those reasons is because it seems that over the next chapters, the laws that Moses gives are meant... They're loosely grouped. It's not very clear. This book that's magnificently literary suddenly seems to fall apart in the middle, which is fine. My homilies do that too. But the reality is if you're going to find a structure in it, it looks like it's actually grouped as subsidiary laws underneath each of the Ten Commandments so that you can trace them one after another and say, oh, these laws are meant to strengthen the first commandment. These laws are meant to strengthen the second commandment. Okay? We're not going to go into each of the laws. That would take too long. But that basic idea seems to be what's going on there. And that structure that's given is a far clearer structure than the structure given on Sinai. Right? So once again, we're in the presence of not just is the law lowered for the sake of the people. The law is now categorized to make more sense to the people. And the law is explained and persuaded to for the sake of the people. It is a real sense of God's pedagogy, right? God tried to teach us algebra and we're like, what are numbers? And so he's like, okay, break it down lower. right? And that doesn't mean that's necessarily a good thing, right? St. Paul's going to fuss at people saying, you should be eating solid meat and you still want milk, right? So we can't just live at the level of being childish. But we do have to recognize that God does lower things to us to where we can understand them, right? And sometimes that lowering is not in itself good, right? Like, it's not bad. It's God who's doing it, but it's not something that we should celebrate. So, for example, somebody comes to me and says they've murdered 45 people. What am I going to give them for their penance? Pray 5 minutes for what you did. I mean, the reality is that if I gave them the full penance that they would owe, they'd never come back to confession. They shouldn't celebrate that they'd get a small penance. They should make it a recognition of, like, this is how close I was to being lost, that I can't even handle adult work when it comes to penance. Right? So if God lowers the law for the sake of the hardness of our hearts, that's not something to celebrate. That's not something to go around saying, oh, see, the church is too rigid, blah, blah, blah. No, it's to recognize, like, no, we're dumb. God had to speak baby speak. He doesn't want us to stay there. There's a reason why he gave kind of the real law first. And then there's a reason why he goes even higher on the Sermon on the Mount. You have read that it was said. You have heard that it was said. He quotes the law from the Old Testament. I say to you. And then the thing he says is like 40 times harder than the law of Exodus. So I just want that to be clear in everybody's head. That God is no favorite, he's not in favor of infantilism when it comes to spiritual life. He doesn't want us to just stay like little children. Childlike always. Childish never. Children can be children. I see like one child in this room. Okay? Alright. One thing I want to mention is chapter 6 before I go on. I know I'm skipping around here, but chapter 6 is the Shema. This is important. Chapter 6, verse 4 and following. Shema, which means hear. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. And these words which I command you this day shall be upon your heart, and you shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them, etc. The Jews took that very literally, by the way, especially by the time of Jesus. Jesus talks about their phylacteries and tassels and stuff. What they would do is they would write out the Shema on a little scroll, and they would actually bind it to their forehead, physically, and bind it to their wrist, so that they always had it on them. Kind of the same way that we, like, always carry a rosary with us. Right? And there's also a tradition that you put it outside the lintel of your house so people touch it when they come in. But this is the Shema is, of course, what Jesus will say is the greatest of the commandments, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. That's the Shema. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is one God. Therefore, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. Jesus is referencing that. People knew what he was talking about. They prayed it several times a day, every day. This wasn't strange to them. Okay? And it comes from Deuteronomy. All right. What I want to talk about now is Deuteronomy is so rich, but we have so much to cover. So, what I want to talk about now is if you go further, starting with chapter 27 really, Moses gives the speech, then he commands everybody, now you got to keep it. And then they carve stones. What does this remind you of? The stone tablets of Sinai, right? Again, law in the ancient world was carved in stone to show that it wasn't going to change. You carve it in stone. They carve it in stone. And then, from Mount Ebal, you have the 12 curses, starting in verse 15, right? Cursed, 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 cursed. They have to repeat this. This was a prayer. They have 18 now that they have to pray. Cursed be the man who does this. Then chapter 28, blessings for obedience. Verse 15, warnings against disobedience. So again, this is a persuasion. But what's going to happen here, this is what happens with Josiah, is Josiah hears these commands of Deuteronomy, They're not exactly the same as Exodus. One of the things that's clear is the centralization of worship, and all other altars need to be torn down. There were altars all over Israel. And Josiah listens to that. He hears the curses. He looks around at how Judah's doing and sees all the curses and says, "Ah!" Right? This is what happened. We've been violating the law of the Lord and we didn't even know it because it was hidden behind a wall. But if you look at what it commands and the curses for disobedience, behold the curses all around me. Okay? And so then he sets out to reform. And it's really sad because Josiah is one of the great saint kings of the Old Testament. There are not many. He's one of the very few really holy ones. And it's at the end of his reign that the Babylonian exile happens. So the last kind of great holy king is the one who loses the kingdom of Israel or the kingdom of Judah altogether. Which causes a question. Because if you just sit with Deuteronomy and the blessings and the curses, you might get close to what we call today prosperity gospel. Okay? If you do right, God's going to send all kinds of money and food and everything your way. If you do wrong, God's going to take it all away. Clearly, that's not what God is trying to communicate. Okay? We know this because he preached the exact opposite when he came in the flesh. So what's going on here? I think the best thing to say of what's going on here is it's part of the same pedagogy. People at a very basic spiritual level understand basic rewards and punishments best. Okay? We know that. Father, since that I prayed my rosary today and my football team won, isn't that wonderful? Sure. Okay. I prayed my rosary like 700 times and my football team always lost. But the reality is, right, the reality is that God in fact does that for people who are at the beginning of the spiritual life in order to woo them into deeper waters, to more maturity. In the same way that when you go to the doctor as a 5-year-old, you get a popsicle or you get a lollipop. Probably not a popsicle, a lollipop. That's what I meant, okay? If I go now, he tells me your blood sugar is too high. See, the difference is, right, the difference is, you're not expected to get a candy for doing your job when you're an adult. And I think that these blessings and curses need to be understood in that light, that this is a pedagogy of the law, still. And God will use those things to train Israel into deeper spiritual maturity. Okay? And then, chapter 31, Joshua becomes Moses' successor. And then, chapter 32 is very, very beautiful. You have the Song of Moses, which is kind of Moses' great summation of his life. We use it in the liturgy in numerous places. Very worthwhile meditating on. I'm not going to read the whole thing. But if you haven't had a chance to read all of Deuteronomy and the other books, which, you know, you should have between 4 o'clock and class, that's a joke. Tonight, if you read nothing else, read chapter 32 of Deuteronomy. It goes through 33 too with his final blessing. And just meditate on that, the final words of Moses. They're very beautiful. And really kind of a summation of everything that God's trying to teach us in the 5 books of Moses, the 5 books of the Torah. All right. Then in chapter 34, Moses dies, right? Remember, he dies before reaching the promised land on Mount Nebo. He can see it. He climbs up the mountain, he can see it. And this really struck home for me when I was in the Holy Land because geographically it makes all kinds of sense in the world. So the Jordan River marks the beginning of the Holy Land. I'm going to have to do this with my hands, and y'all are from Louisiana, so this may not make sense, but you have the Sea of Galilee up north. It's a bayou. The Jordan River is not very powerful. It's basically a bayou that goes down to the Dead Sea, which is the lowest area on the face of the planet. Everything around that is flat. And you have Jericho, the plain of Jericho, right next to the Jordan, which is very verdant because there's underwater wells and everything. There's very, very fertile. But on the horizon, as far as you can see, you get this valley of the river, you get the fertile plain of the Jordan, you get some stuff on the right, and then it's like empty desert. Until on the horizons, on both sides, you see these huge mountain ranges. Whoop, straight up. And I thought, man, I really thought, like back then, I'm like, goodness, if I was an ancient person and had grown up in Jericho, I certainly wouldn't have been walking through the desert to get to the desert mountains. And I could have legitimately thought that the world ended right where I could see. Because it looks like the world is. Right? You've got this flat area, and then what we have as the horizon is just mountains all the way around. All the way around. And they're desert mountains. They're not fertile mountains. And so we'll explain this to Joshua in a second. That's why people could be shocked when suddenly, literally out of nowhere, millions of people just drop down out of the mountains. Oh my goodness, what's going on here? I don't understand. Okay. It would not be dissimilar, I think, to the experience of an alien invasion showing up in our skies. Where did they come from? But it makes perfect sense that God leads Moses up the Jordan side, Jordan today, the modern country of Jordan, the eastern side, on those mountains, on that mountain range, and he can see the Jordan, because it's just flat, flat beneath him. He can see it. He can also see that it's still pretty far away, and he knows that he can't make it. And he dies there on Mount Nebo. Okay. Let's move then to the book of Joshua. No, I lie. Let's move then to the topic of the Deuteronomistic history before we talk about the book of Joshua. The Deuteronomistic history is a theory. But it is a good theory. It's a solid theory. And most scholars buy it. The Deuteronomistic history is the theory that Joshua, Judges, 1st and 2nd Samuel, and 1st and 2nd Kings were all written at the same time, either by the same person or by the same group of people, and were written as an attempt in light of the Babylonian exile to interpret all of Israel's history from the Exodus till now in the light of the blessing and curses of the book that had just been discovered, the book of Deuteronomy. Okay. It makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense on the language used in the different books, a lot of which is specific to that time of the exile. Remember how I said English today is not the same as English of Shakespeare's time, so also Hebrew at the time of the exile was not the same as Hebrew 700 years before. So there are a lot of modern, for lack of a better word, Hebrew words used. It makes a lot of sense in terms of the framing narrative. It makes a lot of sense of why the books don't overlap. They actually do seem to form a steady narrative. Like the events of one end, the events of the next one begin. The events of that one end, the events of that. It looks like a 6-volume history altogether. The language is the same. A lot of the perspective is similar. And that perspective is a perspective that comes from the book of Deuteronomy. Okay? Do y'all understand that? Okay. Now, one of the reasons why people fight against the Deuteronomic history thesis, not many do, but some do, is that there's also a lot of old language in these books, archaic language. And this is where I said we need to talk about ancient practices again. If you were writing a book in the ancient world, if you were writing a book in the early medieval world, if you were writing a book pretty much any time before the year 720 AD, the idea of citing your sources was something you never even thought about. Today, it's a huge thing. If you quote somebody and don't say you're quoting them, you're guilty of plagiarism. In the ancient world, if you quote somebody and didn't say you were quoting them, you were educated. Like, that's what it meant. So there are a few places in these books where the author will explicitly say, I'm quoting this book. Which, by the way, tells you that this is therefore not the words of an eyewitness, but the words of somebody who is literally doing research and quoting books. But they don't have to say it all the time they quote something. They just tell you when they're quoting something because they think you'll be impressed. There can be chapters upon chapters where they're just block quoting someone and they don't even mention it. And again, that was accepted practice in the ancient world. It was normal. That's what you did. Why would you rewrite history when you already have somebody who wrote chapters 3 through 10 for you? Copy and paste, boo. Okay. And remember what I said. I don't know if you remember this. This was some weeks back, but you could literally do that with scrolls. You just cut the scroll, sew in the piece you want, and now you have a complete book. You write the beginning and the end. So, one of the things that we see, especially in Joshua, is we're going to see he quotes some people. Like, as is said in this book of Psalms. Here's the thing, guys. If a book is composed in English, and part of the English sounds like Shakespeare, and part of the English sounds like Will Smith, then clearly that book was written in the 20th or 21st century, not the 17th. Because we can quote Shakespeare today, Shakespeare could not quote Will Smith. Do you understand what I'm saying? So the presence of archaic language makes lots of sense when you realize he's just quoting an older source. But it couldn't be an old book if it has modern language in it, too. All right. So, let's talk about Joshua. Joshua falls into four easy parts, which of course I don't remember. But basically it goes something like this. Okay? It is, Joshua crosses the Jordan with the people of Israel. They finally cross into the Promised Land and renew the covenant. Then they conquer Canaan. Then they parcel out Canaan. And then there's discussion at the end of what's going on. Okay, kind of a reflection. What goes on there. That's the basic motion of Joshua. Joshua, how deep do I want to get into this? Let's say a few things first. Joshua, the name Joshua, was given to him by Moses. It originally was just Hoshea. Now it's Yahushua, which means God saves. It is the same name that Jesus has. Okay. We say them differently in English, but it's the same name. God saves. God saves. Jesus has the exact same name in Hebrew as Joshua. Okay. That means that obviously Joshua is a foretype of Jesus. And we know this. The New Testament is clear about this. Jesus completes the work of Moses. Jesus leads us into the true promised land. Jesus defeats our enemies, etc., etc. Okay. The covenant that Joshua makes has become very popular today, I think especially in that man and you. Is you. Joshua reads out the covenant and then tells Israel, who are you going to serve? God did all this for you. Who are you going to serve? As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. I want to make a theological point about the development of religion at this point in the Old Testament. This may or may not mean a lot to you. If it does, at this point, most scholars of religious history, except the most conservative, would say that Israel is not monotheistic. They are henotheistic. Monotheistic means there is one God, and you have to worship him, her, it, whatever. One. And that's the one God for everything and everyone, period. Henotheism says, my people have one God that we're allowed to worship. But your people have your God that you're allowed to worship, and your people have your God that you're allowed to worship, and you can. And the gods all have equal reality. And so that seems to be what Joshua is actually premising this on, right? We've passed through all these different pagan nations. Here's what our God did for us. There are other options out there. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. This develops by the time of the Babylonian exile. We'll talk about this when we get to the prophets. This develops into a full-on monotheism long before Jesus comes. To where Joshua will kind of say, pick which God you want to serve. Isaiah will say, the gods of the nations are dreams. They're fake. They don't exist. There's only one Lord of heaven and earth. But that helps you understand a lot, both about how God works with people, and a lot about what's going on in the Old Testament, if you kind of understand, they're not fully aware of monotheism yet. They just know that they're allowed to only serve one God, which would make a lot of sense as why they're so tempted to serve other gods. Right? I did what I was supposed to do. Amazon didn't deliver. I'm going to Barnes & Noble. Alright? This seems to be what happened. And this is why God will say, not early on, you worship false gods, but rather you committed adultery with other gods. You broke your covenant with me. You cheated on me. So keep that in the back of your mind. If that means a lot to you, great. If it doesn't, you're like, I don't understand. Don't worry about it. But it is, I think, an important point to understand that the way we understand God develops throughout the Old Testament until the full revelation of Jesus Christ. Okay. Speaking of which, we need to deal with the very difficult reality of God telling Joshua to go around and kill everybody. The ban. How do we deal as Christians with God's commandment to destroy Canaan and the nations of Canaan? There are a couple of things we can keep in mind. The first thing I want you to keep in mind, we can't use this to evade. Okay? I want to be very clear. I'm not trying to evade this. I would never use this to an atheist who tries to point out that we need to be ashamed of these passages. But as a Christian who's reading Scripture and understanding Scripture as we've been doing from a historical and literal level too, we need to remember that Joshua was written centuries after the events that happened. It was written from an idealistic point of view. It is almost liturgical. The way they describe the conquest almost looks like one of the liturgies of Mount Sinai, Deuteronomy. So in other words, this is very clearly not a completely factual history. This is instead a kind of idealistic account of what could have, should have been. And we see that, not least of which, even though Joshua occasionally mentions that there are other nations that were not overcome, it does seem by the time you're done with the book of Joshua that like Israel just kind of waltzed in and suddenly all of Canaan is theirs. And then you turn the page to the book of Judges and suddenly all the pagan nations are oppressing Israel. Where'd they come from? Didn't we just wipe them out? No. Okay. So I'm not saying that the book of Joshua is false in any way. I'm saying it's selective. So if I were to say, for example, watch this. You'll appreciate exactly what I'm saying. You know, if you need to understand the history of America, you start with George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, who gave us independence. And then Abraham Lincoln, who was a Republican, gave independence to the slaves. And now Donald Trump is freeing us from the bureaucracy. Okay, look, see, clearly, I've left a lot of details out that would contextualize that history quite a bit. Doesn't mean I'm lying. It means I'm being selective for a rhetorical point.
So that's the first thing I want you to keep in mind as a Christian. But now if we're going to explain this to people who really struggle with it, who really doubt it, we can say a few things. I don't think any of the answers are good, but they're answers. One of them is that we have to acknowledge that this is a dark passage of the Bible, that it is not as revelatory to us as other passages, and it's entirely possible, because this happened, it's entirely possible that maybe even Israel didn't fully understand what God was trying to communicate. So that's one thing we can say. A second thing we can say is there ultimately a moral difference between God sending the Jewish people to exterminate the pagan nations in Canaan and God sending hail and blood turning to water turning to blood and all the plagues of killing the Egyptians? Like, yeah, on one level, because humans are moral actors, whereas forces of nature are not. But that's where the queasiness comes in, right? I don't think anybody really struggles. I mean, some people do struggle. But most people don't overly struggle with the idea of, like, Israel was doing wicked things, God punished them, he's God, he can do that. Canaan was doing wicked things, God punished them, he's God, he can do that. But this time he used humans instead of hail. Another thing that we can say is that this is by no means, no way, shape, or form, in no manner, genocide. Okay? Because no one in Canaan is ever killed for being ethnically Canaanite. There are numerous people who convert to Judaism and their life is spared. So clearly this has nothing to do with their ethnicity. And nor does Judah ever go outside the bounds of the Promised Land to hunt down all the Canaanites that are out there. It has nothing to do with exterminating a people. It has to do, God's command has to do with getting back land that was stolen and punishing evildoers. Okay. Again, I'm not saying these are good answers. I am saying they are legitimate points to consider. And we have to remember that sometimes you have to approach things, especially in the ancient world, with your head, not your gut. Because we live in a soft age, and any kind of violence today is going to make us think, there's no way God can ever allow that. Well, God punishes people in the Bible. It happens. It happens a lot. And if that makes us feel queasy, then maybe the problem's in us, rather than in him. I think the very last thing that I'll say to this is that I think, and I had a professor who kind of hinted at this, I think this is part of the pedagogy still. Now, you might say, how in the world is killing people part of the pedagogy? Let me explain. When God puts something under the ban, Israel has to destroy it completely. Namely, they get no profit from war. They earn nothing. They gain nothing. There is never any benefit to them from going to war. And they also see very quickly that no matter how much God is with them and no matter how successful they are in battle, battle's not the way to take the Holy Land. It doesn't work! They keep on losing. I'm not going to say, again, I've talked in the past like as if this was God's plan A and plan B. I think we need to understand that humankind, like children, has to touch the stove. It's not enough for God to say, the stove is hot. We have to touch the stove. Okay? And so as part of God's pedagogy, he's going to let us touch the stove. He's going to let us go through every different way to say, this didn't work. Don't try it. And dear brothers and sisters, let's be kind of clear here, not that I'm trying to justify God's actions, but if there has to be a time when Israel tries out religious war and sees that it doesn't work, I would much rather it be when they had swords than nukes. That's a lesson best learned when you're weakest. because the suffering you will impose is the least. And Israel learned early on, conquest ain't going to do it. And from that point on, really, unless they're defending themselves, after the time of the early kings, you never ever hear of a religiously motivated war conquest. Whereas we can compare this to, and I'm not downplaying any other religion, we can compare this to the Islamic idea of jihad, which continues military conquests licensed by God to all kinds of devastation in the world. So, I think that might be part of it too. God knew they were going to do this anyway. Let them do it. Let them see how they make no profit from it, how it's not a good idea, how it's not going to work. And if they're going to do it to people who are very wicked in and of themselves and by their action deserve punishment. And then maybe we can see a glimmer of the justice that's behind this. That doesn't explain the passages fully. I'm not suggesting that it does. I'm suggesting that it gestures toward what we might one day understand in heaven. Does that make sense to everybody? Now, like you, I would much prefer to understand in heaven that the author of Joshua just took poetic license and this never happened. But I don't think we can say that. Okay. However, we can say that some of it is more ideal than historical, including the most famous passage in the book of Joshua. What's the most famous passage in the book of Joshua? Anybody remember? That's the second most famous, but you're good. The walls of Jericho. The walls of Jericho. Anybody know the problem with the walls of Jericho? Archaeologists have proven Jericho didn't have walls for 300 years on either side of when Joshua came in. So, what we see is right after that, there's also the walls of Ai, which is another walled city, which was very big at the time of Joshua. And Ai falls, and it falls in a very similar way to Jericho. And again, I'm not suggesting that the sacred writer made stuff up. That's not what I'm saying at all. But I am saying that their standards were different than ours. And so, he understands that nobody knew what Ai was when he was writing, and everybody knew what Jericho was when he was writing. And so to make the point that God conquered the greatest nation of the time, he took the name of a neighboring town and said, meh. And of course, Joshua did conquer Jericho. It's just the fact that Jericho wasn't that big of a town at the time. Presumably. Or there's something that archaeologists just haven't discovered yet. Which is also possible. And if you want to take it that way, that's perfectly fine too. I know for some people this makes them more nervous than for others. Okay. I, as you can tell, I am very comfortable with Scripture speaking metaphorically, with Scripture speaking poetically, with Scripture speaking figuratively, because I watch when God himself came in the flesh and he did it all the time. Right? He gave the parables, he gave analogies, he gave all kinds of stories. If God himself can do it when he's walking around in the flesh, I don't see why the inspired writers couldn't. That doesn't bother me in the slightest. In the same way that I understand that the parables are actually God's word, even though I don't take them as historical fact. I take them for what they are. And I think the same thing happened. But what we're going to say here is that in Joshua, if we're talking about genres, I think we're more at the level of legend than we are at history. Legend has a historical core. It's about historical people and historical events. But that historical core has been added to with poetic additions so that the inner meaning of those historical events can become more evident to people who hear it. Okay. And that's okay. Right? What do we talk about? George Washington, the cherry tree or whatever, you know? This is not real. But it points to a real aspect of his character. Okay? I know people struggle with this, but I need you to understand that people living halfway around the globe 3,000 years ago did not have the same expectations or thoughts that we do in America today. And people in China 3,000 years from now are not going to think the way we think right now either. So, just be aware of that. Is everybody okay with this so far? Okay. I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on Joshua because it doesn't really excite me. So let's talk about the most important book that we're going to talk about tonight, the thing that you've been waiting for the entire... No, I'm just doing this because people have to leave. I'm sorry. But I do want to talk about Judges. And Judges is very important. And it is very interesting for a number of reasons. One, Judges is the first really messy book we get in the Bible. It is messy. And I don't mean literarily. I mean what's going on is messy. There, like maybe one clear hero in all of Judges. Very few clear indications of God's work. God intervenes, but the way that God intervenes is not always clear. And an abundance of mess, especially in those last chapters of Judges, which are mess upon mess upon mess upon mess. If you haven't ever read the last chapters of Judges, you go, what? What is going on here? So let's talk briefly about Judges, because it has a lot of great stories in it. A lot of great stories in it. So many great stories that you may not recall, but they're all within the same book. Okay? What is the history that Judges is doing? Judges is doing a period of history in between the invasion of Canaan and the advent of Saul's kingdom. Okay. There is no Moses. There is no Joshua. There is no king. Who's in charge? No one. And the principal idea was supposed to be that the people of Israel, the tribes of Israel, would almost, again, I think this is pedagogy, I don't think God was surprised by this, but would almost live in this utopian state, guided simply by the law of God, with no need for a king. Kind of like today, we don't need a government, we just need to pass out the Constitution to everybody and everybody will behave. Right? Yeah, exactly. That worked about as well as you might expect. And again and again and again and again and again and again and again, Israel just goes off the deep end. And God doesn't really send. Let me think about this. I don't know of a single case in Judges. I may be wrong about this, but I don't know of a single case in Judges where God sends a savior to Israel. He sends 12 saviors to a few of the tribes. There's never a savior for all 12 tribes together. It's kind of a patchwork salvation. And this is important, I think. Because, again, it's like trying to... every tribe's separate, every tribe's individual. You know, let's have our own way. Fine. What a judge is very interesting. A judge is not... Obviously, it's not a judge in the sense of a judge of the law court that we would have today. Any of you ever seen the movie... I'm looking at the crowd and I'm guessing probably not. But any of you ever seen either of the movies Judge Dredd? Judge Dredd, thank you. We got one. Okay, great. So Judge Dredd is set way far in the future where crime is rampant. And what you have are judges who are empowered to be policemen, judges, and executioners all in one. And carry out sentence on the spot. That's closer to what a judge is in the book of Judges. They are charismatic leaders empowered by God to enforce His law, answerable to no one, really, except God Himself.
And certainly they're not having like court, they're not having trial. They're looking at situations and imposing God's law. Mostly when Israel has really screwed up and foreign invaders are coming in. Okay? And we even see this, starting with chapter 2. Now the angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bochim, and he said, I brought you up from Egypt and brought you into the land which I swore to give to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall break down their altars. But you have not obeyed my command. Joshua's not even dead yet. Already they're disobeying. They done carved the covenant 14 different times. Mount Sinai, in the plains of Moab, in the center of the Jordan River, outside the Jordan River. There are all these different places where they carved the covenant in stone and said, we'll never break it. Joshua didn't even die before they went around breaking it all over the place. It's bad. And again, let me tell you, I'm coming from a certain position here, but let me just say, again, I think this is pedagogy. And it's the kind of pedagogy that our Protestant brothers and sisters just don't get. Isn't it enough to just have the Word of God and let everyone live with their own interpretation of it? No! Clearly, the entire book of Judges is written to show you, no, this will not work. But won't God raise up a leader? Yes! And things will work for like 10 years. And then they'll go to pot again. If you don't have a structured authority with authority from God, it will not work. And the entire book of Judges shows us this. And in fact, even repeats it numerous times at the end of the book. All this happened because there was no king in Israel. All this happened because there was no king in Israel. All this happened because Pastor Bob said it was okay. All this happened because there was no king in Israel. Again, it's part of the pedagogy. Like, nobody likes authority. Nobody likes institution. Nobody likes structure. As somebody famous once said, I can't remember who it is, democracy is the worst form of government, except for all the others. Okay? And authority and institution and human leaders being empowered with the power of God is the worst possible corruption on the face of the planet, except for every other possible way of doing things. We know it's bad. Israel had bad kings in abundance. We had bad popes in abundance. It stinks. The problem is everything else is worse. Everything else is worse. And I think the period of the judges is explicitly to show the people of Israel this. Okay? Until they get to the point of 1 Samuel where they're begging, give us a king, give us a king, please, please give us a king. He'll tax you, I don't care, give us a king. They literally say this, this actually happened. He'll take your daughters, I don't care, give us a king. Alright. So, let's kind of flip through one of these, some of these. There are 6 minor judges and 6 major judges in the book of Judges. So 12 altogether. I wonder if that's meant to allude to anything. Probably, of course, to the 12 tribes of Israel. But I wonder if it's not meant in some way to gesture toward the apostles. People called by God to lead his people who are themselves deeply flawed. As we see in the judges. The problem I have with that is that one of the 12 judges is a woman, and of course none of the 12 apostles were women, so it kind of falls there, and some other things make it fall too. Like, some of them were like, my children will rule after me. And God's like, nope. So that didn't happen either with the apostles. But I wonder if there's not something there deep down. Okay. Now, Ehud, which is I think the second judge we get, is dealing with Eglon, king of the Ammonites and Amalekites. And this is a fantastic story. You will never forget this story. Okay? It's horrifying. It's disgusting. You will never forget this story. Eglon was fat. Okay? The king was morbidly obese. And Ehud, the judge, this is important, was left-handed. And he comes as, people didn't really know about left-handed back then, and he comes as an ambassador from Israel to the king of the Amalekites, who's oppressing the tribes of Israel. And they search him for a weapon. And they don't search the inside of his right thigh because they assume that he'd have to pull from this side. And there he's hiding a dagger, a sword, where only a left-handed man could grab it. And Eglon goes to the bathroom. And Ehud follows him in and stabs him. Stabs him, this is how fat the guy was, stabs him so much that his stomach swallows the sword. And it says, and the dirt came out. Do I have to translate that image for you? Okay. And the reality is that Ehud gets away. Why? The implicit thing is because the king was so fat that he's used to making a mess in the bathroom that stinks really bad and him screaming and yowling, and his soldiers are used to hearing this. So they don't go investigate when they hear this coming out. Tony, you're never going to forget that story. It's exactly like the miracles of the New Testament, right? Very clear, you know, sometimes God works by changing water to wine. Sometimes he works by a left-handed man taking a sword from his thigh, stabbing it into a guy's stomach and having him poop all over himself. It's fantastic. Okay. And so Israel was delivered, and Israel behaved itself for like 5 minutes, and then Israel fell again. And you have Deborah, who now judges Israel. And Deborah summons Barak, because though she's a prophetess and a judge, she knows she's not a war leader. She says to Barak, go, conquer Sisera. And Barak, it's hard to know what to say with Barak. Is he a coward? Is he faithful? He's like, no, not unless you go with me. I mean, it's one thing to realize, like, okay, we see again and again and again and again and again and again and again in the history of Israel that if God does not go with the Israelite armies, they lose. So is Barak being a coward or is he being faithful when he's like, not unless the one authorized by the Lord comes with me. I'm not just going to go do this on my own. I'm going to die. And Deborah says something really beautiful and strange. She says, listen, if you do it, they'll say that the glory of this battle went to a woman. And Barak's like, okay. And it seems that neither Deborah, maybe, certainly not Barak, realized that the woman was not Deborah. The glory is going to go to another woman than Deborah. But let's talk about real quick, Jael killing Sisera. This is great. So Barak defeats Sisera's army. Sisera flees. Jael is the wife of one of his, like, allies. But she is secretly an ally of Judah. And she's like, oh no, come in, my lord, come in. We'll hide you in here. And he goes into the tent, and she covers him with a rug. Big man. He's like, give me water. And she gives him milk. From the context of what happens, it's clear that this is fermented milk. This is what nomads would drink. It's very powerful alcoholically. Okay? She gets him drunk as a skunk, and he passes out. And Jael takes a tent peg and hammers it through his temple. It's a messy book, y'all. I told you it's a messy book. I was very clear about that. It's a messy book. Okay? And so the glory of the battle went to who? Jael. Neither Deborah nor Barak. Jael, who did this kind of devious thing. And in fact, it's very interesting. This is a very interesting contrast to Joshua, where Joshua and Moses is going around in full view of everybody with armies, marching around, blowing trumpets, military victory. In Judges, most of the time you get victory by cunning. which is a very different approach and an interesting one. Okay? Keep flipping. All right? Then we get Gideon. Now, Gideon is interesting, not least because Gideon's real name is Jerubbaal. He's named after the false god Baal. And he's only called Gideon here. Everywhere else, he's called Jerubbaal. He's called by the name he was given by his father. And his father worships Baal. And Gideon is called to throw down the false altars. And Gideon's like, no. So what I'm going to do is, and Gideon keeps on asking for signs. The most famous one is the fleece. He said, look, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to leave a fleece out on the ground. When we come in the morning, I expect that fleece to be wet and the entire ground to be dry. He comes back and it is. And then Gideon, being not stupid, says, well, that could have happened naturally because fleece collects dew. So now what you do is the reverse. I'm going to come back tomorrow morning. I expect the ground to be wet and the fleece to be dry. Gideon doesn't give God a break ever. He's constantly testing God. Which will make a lot of sense of what God then does to Gideon, which is poetic justice. So God finally sends Gideon, go, and Gideon gathers 22,000 men for his army, and God says 12,000 of them are cowards, send them home. He's already outnumbered. Okay, send them home. You see, now God's going to test Gideon the way that Gideon tested God. And then God's like, nah, you still got too many men. Bring them down to the river to drink. And those who bent down to drink, which was the vast majority, were dismissed. Whereas those who cupped the water and drank out of their hand were not. Why? Because if you're bending down to drink, you're no longer guarding against enemy soldiers. But if you're cupping the water and drinking from your hand, you're still aware of what's going on around you. And the army then went from 22,000 to 300. And God's like, that's a good number. Okay. And fighting the Midianites. And what Gideon does is very interesting. God tells Gideon, you're not even going to fight them. Again, this is cunning. You're going to go out. They didn't have night attacks back then. It was very dangerous. It still is dangerous to do a night attack, but especially with the technology they had then, it was very dangerous. You're going to go out by night. You're going to have torches within jars. And you're going to have trumpets. And what you're going to do is, as you draw around, you're going to surround their entire campsite with these 300 people. You're going to shatter the jars so that the flames all suddenly burst out of the darkness. And you're going to blow the trumpet victory for Gideon and God. And they do this. And the Midianites freak out. They have no idea what's going on. They're woken up and they start slaughtering each other because they think it's the enemy army. And the 300 men never pick up a sword. And the Midianites just wipe each other out. Okay? Gideon has a son, Abimelech. Abimelech tries to make himself king after wiping out 77 of his brothers. That does not work. I'd like to say more about this, but we have to move on. I'm so sorry. Until we get to Samson. There are other judges we should talk about, like Jephthah. But we're going to talk about Samson. Samson's the one you know, right? Samson is a mess from beginning to end. Samson is a mess. Okay? So this angel appears to Samson's mother, to the wife of Manoah, and says, you're going to bear a son. Her name's not even named. Huh? Okay, sure. I mean, she's not barren. There's no indication. I mean, I think it says she's barren, but she's not old. There's no indication that she wasn't capable of physically having children yet. She wasn't asking for a child. This is not like any other miraculous birth in the scriptures. It just happens. An angel just appears and says, hey, by the way. And then he consumes their sacrifice with his magic wand. It's fantastic. This actually happens. I'm not making that up. And then they ask him what his name is. He's like, shut up. You don't get to know my name. My name is Nunya. No, he says, why do you ask my name, which is too wondrous for you, which is why we should also not ask angels their names when scripture tells us not to ask angels their names. Okay? So, Samson is consecrated as a Nazarite from his youth, right? We hear this. We've talked about this already. He's not allowed to drink strong wine. He's not allowed to drink wine, strong drinks, eat any grapes even, not even raisins. He cannot touch dead things. and he can't let a razor touch his head. Okay? The problem with Samson is he does all of these things. Okay? And he's filled with God's glory. And like, even the stuff, like if you don't pick up on this, you're like, ah, like you miss things that are going on. And Samson's story is complicated. We don't have time to get into it. But just to give you an idea, there's like one point where he slaughters people with the jawbone of an ass, which is by definition a part of a dead body. Another time he eats honey out of a dead lion's mouth. By definition, contact with a defiling dead body. Then he rags on people on it by making a riddle about it at his own wedding feast, where it seems he gets drunk at his wedding feast. You're not even allowed to drink, he gets drunk. And he still has the power. So he goes to the Philistines. We'll talk about the Philistines more next time. Kills a bunch of Philistines to get his rage out, comes back, and his wife is married off to somebody else. And he's like, why'd you do that? Well, because you left in the middle of the wedding. We thought you didn't want to be married anymore. Okay. Right? And then he gets trapped several times by the Philistines. He kills a bunch of them. The last time, of course, is Delilah seduces him. And Samson is so stupid. I mean, he's stupid so much. And it's not just that he's stupid that he tells a woman this. She asks him, what makes you weak? He tells her three lies, and he wakes up on three mornings with the three lies having happened to him. If you tie my feet with cord, it will make me weak. He wakes up the next morning, his feet are tied with cord. Oh, I wonder what happened there. Right? And he snaps it, like, three lies! Finally, she just annoys him to where he says, you know, if you cut off all my hair, I'll lose my power. Because that's the last part of his Nazirite vow that he hasn't broken. And so she holds him down, ties him up, shaves off his head. He wakes up the next morning, he thinks God is still with him. He tries to go fight. He's like, okay. He gets kidnapped. He gets dragged into the temple of Dagon, I think. Philistine God. And I love it. I love it. I love it. It says, they blinded him and made fun of him. And Judges says, but Samson's hair had started to grow. And when he gets mad enough, he pushes on the actual supports of the temple and brings the whole thing down, killing himself but destroying tons of Philistines and the false gods. Okay. Now, part of what's going on here, I think, is poetic. It's fun poetry. The name Samson seems to mean son of the sun, S-U-N. So there's also some poetic idea here of you're slicing off his rays. And if you slice off the rays of the sun, he's powerless. But when the rays come back, he's strong again. Okay. But there's more to go to that. But let me say real quick, because I do want to talk about Ruth before we leave, what happens at the end of Judges. There's a mess. What is the book of Judges? A mess. So you have a Levite, who actually we find out later is Moses' grandson. Who's just walking through Israel, looking for a job, and a guy says, hey, by the way, buddy, I have this false idol here with my household gods. I'll even make you an ephod, a little breastplate that holds the lot. You want to come work at my house? Yeah, that sounds good. He just goes start worshiping a false god, leads a false religion. And then the Danites, who are tired of messing with the Philistines because of all the mess Samson did, leave the allotted land that God gave them, and they come into this land. And they're like, hey, nobody's here. It's a rich land. This guy here looks like a wuss. And, oh, by the way, he's got a Levite. Hey, Levite, how you doing? Levite's, hey, it's great. I'd like to serve you guys now. Hey, well, we have our own new religion. It's going to be fantastic. So they do this. But first, the people who come in take the Levite. And what to do with him as the men of Sodom did. And the Levite's like, no! Here's my host's wife and my own concubine. Take them instead. And unlike what happened in Sodom, the two women actually do get abused. Terribly. And then the Levite wakes up the next morning and looks at his concubine and is like, what you crying about? Let's go. And then she dies. The book of Judges is what? He cuts her up into 12 parts. and brings the 12 parts of her body to the 12 tribes of Israel and says, I want vengeance for what they did to my concubine. What they did? You're the one who offered her. And they go and there's civil war among the tribes of Israel. And the book of Judges says, and they did all this because there was no king in Israel. The mess. It even says, everyone did what felt right to him because there was no king in Israel. Okay, now, in the midst of all this mess, we're going to turn to the last very brief but very beautiful book of Ruth. Ruth is not part of the Deuteronomistic history. Okay? It is set during this time. That's why it's found in this place in our Bibles. But it is not part of the six-volume history that is the Deuteronomistic history. Okay? What is Ruth? It depends on who you ask. Thomas Paine, very famous for his pamphlets on freedom in our country, said that Ruth was a bumbling mess of a work that had a cousin trying to get in her cousin's bed, but at least didn't have the murder and rapine of the other books of the Bible. Thomas Paine, by the way, not a fan of the Bible. But Goethe, the great German poet Goethe, who was one of the greatest literary figures who ever lived, said that Ruth is the most perfect short piece of literature we have from the entire ancient world. And most people tend to agree with Goethe. It is a tiny book. It's 3 pages in my Bible. But it is magnificent in its literary development and story and everything. So what happens is there's this family from Bethlehem. They leave Bethlehem because there's a famine in Bethlehem. This is irony in the extreme. Bethlehem means house of bread. There's no bread in the house of bread. They leave Bethlehem and go to Moab. They cross the Jordan. They leave the promised land just to find food. Exactly like, you know, the sons of Jacob did to Egypt. And the man dies. His wife's name is Naomi. She has 2 sons, and they marry 2 Moabites. Moabites? I don't know. 2 female Moabites. They die too. One of the widows of the son is Ruth. And Naomi says, I'm going back to Bethlehem. I have no sons. I have no man. I have no way to make a living. I hear the famine's ended. I'm going back to my family. And Ruth says very beautifully, we sing this at weddings, which is so insane to me because it's a daughter-in-law to her mother-in-law. Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lead, so shall I be. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Which, I mean, we sing as if it's something between a man and a woman. Like, no, it's a daughter-in-law to a mother-in-law, which, by the way, makes it so much more impressive. Because Ruth abandons everything. Her God, her people, everything, because she loves her mother-in-law and doesn't want to see her mother-in-law starve to death, presumably. Wherever you go, I will go. Goes into the land of Israel, where she's not welcome. And she goes and gleans from the field of Boaz. God has commanded in the law that you not harvest the field all the way to the edges so that the poor and the starving can come and glean the leavings. Long story short, Boaz notices her, tries to protect her. Naomi says, hey, by the way, he's your cousin through marriage. And by Israelite law, he has the right of first refusal to marry you now that you're a widow. And Boaz does. And it's a beautiful story. We're not going to go into the details because it's 729, but it's a beautiful story about love, about commitment. But it's an incredible story because Ruth is like the great-great-grandma of David. Okay? This is God's plan to bring about the Davidic line. One of the beautiful things is in Matthew, where Matthew gives the genealogy of Jesus, he lists 3 women, only 3 women, and all 3 women were Gentiles. And I think it is profound and beautiful to the extreme. Does anyone know on what day of the year the Jewish people read Ruth in the liturgy? Pentecost. Pentecost. The day that would become when the apostles speak in the language of all nations and bring all the Gentiles in. That's when they were reading Ruth in the temple. The story of a Gentile woman who converted and became part of the chosen people and became the ancestress of the Messiah. Right? It's this profound story of love, of dedication. It's very calm, none of the mess of Judges. It's very beautiful. And it's a very beautiful story of the other side of God's providence, right? Not just the pedagogy, not just the dealing with failure, not just the lowering the law, but like even in the smallest things, God is at work powerfully. Because I promise you, nobody would have looked at Ruth and Boaz and said, they're the ancestors for the Messiah. One of the reasons they wouldn't have said it is because nobody even knew a Messiah was coming yet. They were just people. Ordinary people in a broken family. No miracles were worked. Nothing extraordinary happened. Just human hearts guided by God that lay the path for our salvation. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, glory be to the Father.